Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Business for South Africa eyes a rescue plan for collapsing Johannesburg services. Africa Energy Week draws 27 ministers and 7,000 delegates to Cape Town. The Carlton Centre is labelled worth close to nothing as Transnet fails to find a buyer. And the Tobacco Control Bill threatens the vaping industry and jobs and is fueling illicit trade fears. It's Monday, the 29th of September. Now, it's common cause that Johannesburg is in crisis. Power, water, roads and basic services are collapsing under the weight of mismanagement and debt. Now, business leaders are stepping in, arguing the city is too important to fail. Business for South Africa, that's the grouping that has helped steady Eskom and Transnet, is reportedly turning its attention to Johannesburg. And from the grouping, I'm in conversation now with Martin Kingston. I guess the question is whether the private sector intervention can succeed where local government has consistently come up short. Martin, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe the first question is a technical one. How would you avoid duplicating or crowding out existing city initiatives? You would have to work hand in hand in order for this to work.
Yeah, well, that's the key question, Jeremy, that you've asked, of course. In all of our work to date, whether it be in crime and corruption or indeed energy or transport and logistics, as you've mentioned, our first job has been to see what work is already taking place, both in the public sector and in the private sector, and then seeing how best we can leverage private sector skills and capacity and bring that to bear. In this particular case, I think that there's a sort of a high level of awareness that there are many initiatives underway, both in the public sector at the level of both the municipality, but going right up to a presidential task force, as well as individual private sector initiatives. But what is clear is that it's not having the impact that is required, both in terms of fundamentally changing the trajectory for the city, but also the optics. We are very concerned that for all the good work that the country is doing, it is undermined by a perception that the city is failing, whether it is correct or not, and that needs to be addressed as a matter of urgency.
Why do you think the current work being done by a multiplicity of players is not having the impact, as you've suggested?
Well, first of all, it's not coordinated. We know that. One of the key elements of the partnership between government and business has been to identify what are the absolutely essential priorities and drivers, what are the interdependencies between them, and to bring project management skills to bear, particularly those honed in the private sector, to work alongside and in support of government to ensure that those priorities are properly resourced, that the key decisions are taken by government and then implemented. So you can have a multiplicity of initiatives, but actually the problem is that we get gridlock over time. The second, and we need to deal with this head on, is the level of crime, corruption and maladministration that we're finding, both in the public and in the private sector. We can't deal with that as Business for South Africa. That's not our role or responsibility, but we need to call it out and we need to make sure that the state is strengthened to be able to address it. And thirdly, and again, you'll be very well aware of this, as will your listeners, the politics that are at work. We've made it clear from the outset that we're not prepared to get involved in politics at a local or indeed provincial or national level. That's the responsibility of the government of the day. We've raised that directly with the president. But despite all of that, we do think there are two or three key initiatives that could be scaled. Certainly, as you've mentioned, in the context of infrastructure, we absolutely need to bring to bear disciplines, accountability and responsibility that is clear for all to understand and see with respect to, for example, as you say, infrastructure, build and roll out, repairs and maintenance, the rehabilitation of key aspects of the inner city as well as the city more broadly.
You say you'll stay out of politics, but how realistic is that really in Johannesburg, Martin?
Well, I don't think that we can actually have any useful impact in politics. There's a perception, it's completely incorrect, that business is involved in either lobbying or pulling strings with respect to political outcomes. Actually, that's neither our role and responsibility, nor is it effective, I think, in our experience and the experience of many of the CEOs who are involved with this. We need to be aware of it. I think we need to call it out privately, constructively. But in the final analysis, the city of Johannesburg is going to have to take responsibility for its actions. And ultimately, that flows up to government at national level and the political parties concerned. We're all very well aware of the fact that the local government elections are upon us probably in the next 14 months or so. We're not doing this to try and secure any competitive advantage for any of the political parties. Nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is that whilst we are not able to ensure that Johannesburg, as the economic hub of South Africa, thrives and prospers, as I said, all of our other efforts are undermined. We've got economic growth of 1% or below as a country, and Johannesburg is a key contributor to that, either in ensuring we do have that growth or indeed undermining the prospects for that growth.
This really sounds like 11th hour stuff. Is this intervention not coming too late? Should you not have done this a lot earlier?
Yeah, that's a good point, Jeremy. The reality was that we needed to get the first three initiatives up and running. We needed to ensure that none of the efforts that we were expending, both in the public and the private sector. I mean, the private sector has committed over 750 subject matter experts to the other areas and over 350 million rands worth of cash support, either by procuring expertise for the government and or for the private sector side of the partnership. The reality is that we weren't prepared to detract from that focus by looking at other areas. At the president's request, we added unemployment and in particular a focus on youth unemployment. We all recognize the gravity of the situation there. And at our most recent meeting with the president just over 4 weeks ago, once again, Johannesburg got raised as a major concern and a request that we should actually bring the same sort of heft to bear, the coordination skills that were in place, as we'd done elsewhere. And we believed that that absolutely required us to take stock to assess whether there was indeed a real prospect for us to get involved. We haven't committed to do so until we have assessed the situation, which we'll do in the coming month or two.
Once you've done that, and let's assuming the initiative goes ahead, how would point chief executives or operatives be chosen? And surely there would be a concern about conflict of interest.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So in all of our areas, we're very mindful of conflicts of interest. We've agreed a set of principles with the government where we ensure that there is no scope whatsoever for people who've got a particular interest being able to prosecute that independently, if you like, a national interest. There are many, many chief executives, whether they be of financial institutions, whether they be of other major companies that are dependent upon an effective and operating city, who are not conflicted at all, but who have, I think, the best interests of the city at heart. We've spoken to the vast majority of them. What we've seen in the Business for South Africa initiative, Jeremy, is that many CEOs, 160 plus, have thrown their hat into the ring to say they're prepared to sign a pledge. And of that, a large number getting personally involved in overseeing the initiatives concerned at all times, as you said, mindful of the fact that not only can there be any conflict, but there cannot be any perception of conflict. So we will address that straight up before we announce the names of any such individuals.
Martin Kingston, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, on to skyscrapers now. And once the crown jewel of Johannesburg's skyline, the Carlton Centre now stands as a decaying relic. Empty, dark, falling apart in many respects, yet still owned by Transnet, which bought it decades ago. After a failed sale attempt, silence from management, profit margins that barely cover maintenance costs, critics, I think, are wondering whether the precinct is at all salvageable. Well, with me now is Brian McKechnie, who is a well-known heritage architect here in Johannesburg, and he's publicly questioned the building's future. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. If I've read this correctly, you're suggesting that Carlton is probably worth close to nothing. How do you arrive at that conclusion? Previously, if I'm not mistaken, it was on sale for something like 900 million rand.
Thanks, Jeremy. Look, it's an interesting building to value. And I think, the fact that the building was on sale at 900 million and that there were no successful bids that were received. And it's not the first time that Transnet has tried to sell that complex. I think that certainly suggests that, the 900 million is wishful thinking. In valuing the building, you'd need to look at what its potential uses are. At the moment, while the retail space is still quite vibrant and they've got really good retail tenants on that ground level of the building, the hotel is sitting completely vacant and is in incredibly poor condition now. And the office tower is also largely vacant. So, as a commercial building, your potential revenue generation is low. And then you'd need to look at things like, the potential costs of a conversion of the building if you looked at trying to change it into something like affordable housing, which is a model that seems to work quite well in the inner city. But obviously, in a skyscraper like that, which has been poorly maintained probably since 1997 or 98 when Transnet bought it, your conversion costs are going to be unbelievably high. So you've got to you've got to discount your sale price, related to the cost of conversion for a current use.
Brian, unbelievably high. Have you applied your mind to what it would cost to either restore or convert the building?
So that's a difficult question, and you'd kind of need to use a provisional cost figure at this stage. It would need quite a substantial investigation into, firstly, what type of new use you'd want for that building, and then secondly, a condition assessment to actually understand exactly what the current or present condition of the building is. So no, I haven't, but conversion costs are quite expensive, especially on skyscrapers like Carlton. As an architect, you'd need to look at things like your provision of natural lighting. The floor plates in that office tower are incredibly deep. It's not a building that was ever designed with residential in mind. So while the hotel section of the building might convert quite easily into affordable housing, the office tower is far more difficult, and it's a massive, massive building. So I think, it's not the kind of project that a small developer could take on. You need a really large, established developer to take that type of project on, and they need very deep pockets.
How do you reconcile heritage? Because there's no doubt, Brian, that it occupies a place in the heritage firmament in Johannesburg. It's an integral part of the skyline, with restoration costs, with functionality, with the future.
Look, I absolutely agree. Carlton is an important part of Johannesburg's heritage, Jeremy. It is an icon of Joburg. I think even today, although there are buildings in Johannesburg that are now taller than Carlton, I think when you speak to most Joburgers about skyscrapers, the first one that they think about is probably the Carlton Centre. So it's iconic. It's certainly part of our heritage. But it's also important that these buildings are used. I mean, if it becomes a building that is no longer used at all, it's obviously going to fall even further into decay, which threatens the long-term sustainability of that heritage asset. So it's absolutely essential that a new use is found for the building, and that an owner that would look after the building is also found for it. You can't say, because it's heritage, we're going to leave it exactly as it is, because you're basically then dooming the building to destruction through decay. So we've got to find, or there needs to be a way to find a new use and a new owner for the property to preserve it.
There's also a sentiment debate, though. If Transnet continues to keep the building mothballed, it does send a negative message out, does it not, about Johannesburg's broader decline. That has an impact on investment.
Oh, absolutely, Jeremy. And I think, unfortunately, so many of the buildings that are in incredibly poor condition in the inner city are buildings that either belong to parastatals or belong to provincial government. There's the whole provincial government precinct around Besnardier Square, which I think is 21 buildings and sites. All of those are also in incredibly poor condition. So effectively what government is doing is they're creating sinkholes in the inner city. There are plenty of private sector investors who've invested substantially in downtown Joburg, in all sorts of projects that have made a huge difference to the general character of the area and have improved the area substantially. But then, you've got these massive sinkholes that are created by governments. And it's difficult to kind of work around them, especially when the sinkholes are as large as what the Carlton is.
I suppose it also raises the question, does it not, about whether Transnet in the first place should have been in the property business?
That's a good observation, Jeremy. And yes, Transnet's key business is rolling stock and railways. Absolutely not owning buildings. And I mean, you know, the results of that speak for itself. You can see the decline of the Carlton from the point when Transnet bought it from Anglo American, when it was still probably a P grade or triple A grade office space. And over the 30 years that they've owned it, you can see this substantial decline in the asset, specifically because it's not the core business of Transnet. They don't know how to look after buildings.
And just a final one, if you had the power of decision, what's the boldest move that you'd make tomorrow for the Carlton Centre?
Look, if I was at Transnet, I would sell it, even if it meant, you know, a token sale where you find a responsible developer who's got a good track record, who can take on a project of that size. And even if it was a sort of token sale of a rand, you would be getting rid of a substantial liability on Transnet's balance sheet, and you would be creating, an opportunity for urban regeneration and for a new and sort of better story for the downtown area of Johannesburg. Brian, yeah, it's almost like a no-brainer.
Brian McKechnie, thank you very much indeed. Heritage architect here in Johannesburg.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, Africa Energy Week gets underway in Cape Town today. The event has established itself as an important platform for showcasing innovation and new projects in the energy sector, as well as promoting dialogue that will shape the future path of the energy system on the continent. Make no mistake, this is an important gathering. And this week, ministers from 27 nations will be in attendance, as well as high-level representation from lending institutions and industry heavyweights in the private sector. With close to 7,000 delegates expected to attend, well, what can we expect? I'm in conversation now with Andrew Maggs, who's managing editor of Africa Mining Watch. So, Andrew, first of all, we're living in an era of heightened geopolitical tension, particularly in the Middle East and in Ukraine. Moreover, we're seeing a greater use of sanctions and tariffs in global trade. How is all of this going to impact the energy landscape in Africa, and what are the likely outcomes? I imagine this will be high on the agenda.
Jeremy, to attend these events, these geopolitical events, may seem very distant, but such conflicts and tensions have focused attention on the importance of energy security and the priority of delivering secure and affordable energy. For some countries in Africa, it may mean reducing their dependency on imported fossil fuels and accelerating the transition to greater electrification powered by domestic low-carbon energy. It also doesn't help that in the United States, you now have a president who is at odds with the greater scientific community. In his address to the United Nations General Assembly last week, President Trump declared that climate change is the biggest con job ever perpetrated against the world. Now, it's easy to dismiss this as bluster and rhetoric, but the fallout is very real and is impacting Africa. It's evidenced, for example, by the US government terminating its Power Africa initiative launched back in 2013 by Barack Obama. 150 new power projects were commissioned under Power Africa, and it also served as an important catalyst to mobilize in the region of $29 billion in power project finance from other institutions. So you can well understand the impact of these foreign policy decisions made by the Trump administration.
I'm assuming this event also provides individual countries with an opportunity to put forward their respective investment cases. In your assessment, then, which countries stand out as best prospects?
Jeremy, it does, yeah. One country that comes to mind is Namibia, and it'll be interesting to see how it is reinforcing its position in the forefront of hydrogen development on the continent. It seems every second country now is scrambling to produce a hydrogen master plan or a hydrogen roadmap, but Namibia really is intent on exploiting the opportunity. of course, the country benefits from abundant solar and wind resources, along with vast amounts of government-owned land. This allows project development and centralized planning of so-called hydrogen valleys or dedicated zones for producing and distributing hydrogen at scale. A number of countries, including Libya, Angola, Tanzania, are launching or continuing with bidding rounds through 2025 and next year for oil and gas exploration. So we will likely get updates on these developments. The government of Equatorial Guinea is taking the opportunity this week to launch its 2026 licensing round for on and offshore exploration.
And Andrew, closer to home, what kind of message can we expect from South Africa's government in terms of finding an energy mix that provides, I imagine, reliable and affordable power on the one hand, but also advances our renewable energy ambitions?
Jeremy, I think the message is clear, and that is South Africa will continue to utilize all available resources in its energy mix. And although huge strides have been made in implementing the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program, fossil fuels, and here we're talking about coal, will continue to be the dominant source for power generation in this country. However, with an aging fleet of coal-fired power plants, it's inevitable that these will be replaced at some stage with cleaner options as these assets near life end. Of course, nuclear power will still feature prominently as part of the country's energy mix going forward as well. South Africa will also look to enhance regional cooperation and the need for investment in cross-border energy infrastructure, particularly transmission infrastructure. And also worth mentioning, with the Upstream Petroleum Development Bill having been signed into law, there's now greater regulatory clarity and a far more streamlined method to process applications, making market entry for exploration companies in South Africa far easier.
And just a final one, much has been made of natural gas as a so-called transition source of energy as we replace fossil fuels that you've already alluded to, such as coal with renewable energy. Does gas represent the best path then to a cleaner future?
Jimmy, I think it does. I mean, there's no doubt that Africa's gas to power potential is huge. And if realized, it will play a significant role in this transitioning phase. Sub-Saharan Africa holds enough gas resources to generate 400 gigawatts of power, but only about 20 gigawatts of installed capacity exists. But that number is set to increase significantly with a number of countries bringing large gas-to-power projects into commission. For example, Senegal, Mauritania, Nigeria, and Mozambique. In fact, in Mozambique, probably the best example is ExxonMobil's huge Rovuma LNG project, which should start producing in 2028.
I'm going to leave it there. Andrew Maggs, thank you very much indeed, Managing Editor of Africa Mining Watch.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's new tobacco control bill is moving through Parliament, and it could change the way that vaping and other so-called harm reduction products are regulated. Now, supporters say it's a necessary step for public health, but critics are arguing that it risks wiping out small business, stifling alternatives for smokers, and pushing consumers back to illicit markets. The Vapor Products Association of South Africa has been at the center of this debate, and I'm in conversation now with its chief executive officer, Asanda Ngoyi. Asanda, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. The bill, does it strike the right balance between protecting public health and supporting harm reduction? Where are your concerns?
Hi, Jeremy. The bill in its current form does absolutely nothing to differentiate. So essentially, we've got a bill that is trying to put the same restrictions on vaping products as it does for tobacco products. So it doesn't recognize harm reduction. And obviously, we believe that this is a missed opportunity.
What do you say to claims that vaping, though, is simply another way of keeping people addicted to nicotine?
I think when you understand, Jeremy, why people smoke, we know that people smoke for the nicotine, but we also understand that half the users of cigarettes are going to die prematurely due to the diseases that cigarettes cause. So when you are after nicotine, we say then, how can you provide those individuals that are not willing to quit smoking and those that don't want to quit? How do you provide them with this nicotine? Then vaping becomes an avenue that can give them that nicotine that they want. So I think for those critics who say that it's keeping people hooked on nicotine, you have to understand that that's the very product, that's the very thing that smokers are addicted to.
Your organization is critical of the bill. Have you quantified the numbers in terms of how many small businesses and jobs are at risk if it's passed in its current form, the one that you are critical of?
So it's not just about the businesses, Jeremy. I mean, when you look at overall, South Africa has over 11 million smokers. And with what I said earlier, we know half of those individuals are at the risk of dying. So consumers will be without alternatives. So they won't have the choices that they can choose on what they want. And number two, from a small business point of view, our industry is made predominantly of small businesses. Over half of those businesses will be wiped out. And that's job losses, you know, and that's people's incomes. And it has a cascading effect, obviously. So it's not really just about the business side of things, but I think from a broader public health narrative, it's imperative that we go back to the drawing board and look at how we incorporate tobacco harm reduction into the current bill.
Well, talking about going back to the drawing board, at this point in the process, are government and regulators engaging meaningfully with your industry, with your organization, or is it your contention that this is simply a one-sided process?
Engagement is happening because, I mean, we've presented at the public hearings, we've recently presented at the oral parliament presentations. But the worrying trend that we've picked up from regulators is there tends to be a biasness towards a particular set of evidence that's presented. So what we've been calling for is to say that allow everyone, yes, allow everyone to come and bring in their different viewpoint, but it should never be a box-ticking exercise where you've already made up your mind on what you're going to do. And that's been our biggest concern. But I think the process has been transparent enough. We've seen different views. We've seen different scientific evidence coming to the fore. And our hope is that Parliament will do its job and ensure that it reconciles both sides of the argument to come up with something that is fit for purpose for the South African public.
But if that doesn't happen, and as you've suggested, it seems that minds have already been made up, inevitably this is going to end up in court.
We don't rule that out, Jeremy, because I mean, at the end of the day, we understand public policy making process ought to look at all the available evidence that's put before you. And it is the responsibility of legislators to make sure that it is not driven by ideology, which we've seen in a number of policies. So this is going to be a very big test for the Portfolio Committee on Health, that are they going to look at the scientific evidence, empirical data, and make an informed decision. And if that doesn't happen, we are not ruling taking the process to court or taking the bill to court as an industry, if that's what needs to happen.
And you're pushing for self-regulation, right?
We're not pushing for self-regulation. We've been self-regulating in the absence of legislation. So the vaping industry is currently operating in a legislative vacuum. So obviously, one is bound to have a lot of problems, you know, when you're not regulated. So the industry has taken it upon itself to create frameworks that somewhat guide the industry. So we've created various self-regulatory frameworks in terms of how we market, how we package, restricting these products to young people, but they are not enforceable for businesses that are not in the association. That's why we've been calling for regulation, because we need it as an industry to ensure that every player is accountable.
And that's fundamentally the problem, because we see many reports of under 18s still accessing the products that you represent.
Yes, that's been the biggest problem. And I mean, this is something we've seen coming as far back as 2021, because if you are going to have every person come into the space, there's absolutely no requirements to sell vaping products. You are bound to have problems. And when we call for people in the space to join the association, some don't want to join the association because we're actually quite strict on what we permit. So I'm not surprised of the problems that we have currently, which is why a bill is something that we need, as in yesterday, to close this gap.
Just a quick one in conclusion. Are there lessons maybe that Parliament should be taking from international models of regulation?
Yes, we've presented to them. There's been different stakeholders coming from these countries that have looked at that have presented to Parliament, and the idea has always been you've got three options when you look at regulation. You can have a restrictive model where you ban things. You can look at it from a cautious approach where you restrict flavors, etc. But the likes of countries like New Zealand, UK, Sweden have adopted a risk proportionate approach that says products are different in their risk profile. Therefore, you need to regulate them based on that risk. And that's what we've been advocating for, to ensure that you protect young people, but you still ensure that adult smokers have the option to choose the kinds of products that they want to use.
Sandra Ngoi, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer from the Vapor Products Association of South Africa. And that is where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.